We're going to be working this week on the chaos in God's garden. This is a Bible study that's going to be looking at gardens in the context of the Old and New Testament. We're going to be thinking about what it means that God created a garden at the very beginning of things, and that a lot of important and significant things in Scripture happen in the context of gardens. Green places, places of refuge, places of respite. And in a funny kind of way, later in the tradition, the desert becomes a garden. If you remember John the Baptist and Jesus, they go out into the desert. It's in a sense to go to a place which will allow them to become, to bear fruit or to become abundant. So there are these places. The other reason that I think this is very important to think about gardens is because Holden is a garden. Many of us. Holden Village is a place where we come to as a place of perfection for some, as a place of refuge for other people, as a place of decision for some people, a place to find some hope and some perspective. So we're going to look at gardens for 5 days this week and talk a little bit about our own experience of healing, of chaos, of greenness, of youngness, and see that in Scripture as well. First, I want to get some impressions, though. Apart from Scripture, to start with our own experience, what are the gardens in your life? I mean, what do you think of when you think of a garden? What kinds of, have any of you ever grown gardens? Do any of you come from farms?
Vegetables and weeds and flowers.
Well, tell me something about a garden. If I didn't know anything about gardens, what could you tell me about a garden?
First, we rototill some more, and we plant. I started with my dad's, about 100 and some. We gladiolus, and comes a vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm. So you are a big planter. You do a lot of work digging up.
Ourselves.
Mm-hmm. A lot of digging, a lot of preparing. What other experiences do people have with gardens? Other kinds of gardens?
Well, I love to garden, and I find that I have to plant everything early in April or May because we always have a June like this,
mm-hmm.
and nothing will germinate in June.
So having a garden means that you have to think about the elements and sort of plan ahead. You almost have to be wily. You have to be smart about. Beating the system almost. What else do you know about gardens?
I had an experience with a garden last week. I have had a kind of a feeling that I should go to Madagascar or something because I'm alone and maybe God wants me out there. And then during the week, a lot of people were coming to my door. And during that time, I went to work in my messy yard, which is not all manicured and perfect. It's not rototill yet, and all it's to do with all the weeds and all the mess. And still, it's kind of beautiful because it has trees like here and it has, mm-hmm. you know, some grass, a lot of moss and weeds. And then I looked out and I thought, no, this is God's garden and he's telling me something. The weeds and the flowers and the grass and the nice trees and the dead trees all have a story. And this is my backyard.
Uh-huh.
And my mission is the backyard. So that's how I identify gardens.
So for you, a garden is just letting God do what God is doing. Just letting go. That's interesting.
Put the seeds in and hope they grow.
Somebody remind me, there's a British garden and a French garden, right? The British garden is just seemingly organized chaos, but it's chaos. And the French garden is everything in rows. Well, it sounds like you've got a French garden and you've got a British garden.
Uh-huh.
It's a whole different idea of gardening and of what is beautiful. Because the British just don't find that kind of organization to be at all expressive of their spirit of growth. I suppose a Holden garden would be someplace up in the past where nobody has ever been before, wouldn't it?
Well, God has to do it for me, see, so I really see God in the garden,
uh-huh.
because I don't do it that much.
Okay, other experiences, yeah?
Well, I just think of you're working in cooperation with the Creator and then there is a fruit of your effort.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you throw in the seed, but you...
Well, God provides the sunshine and the rain and created the life.
Do any of you remember back to elementary school when you first found out that the the lima beans that your mother made you eat every week could actually, if you got to the lima beans before your mother got to them, you could put them in water and grow something. Just remember that.
You find test tubes and little pieces of cotton. And
yeah. Wasn't that an amazing thing? I mean, didn't that just like transform everything for you? To realize that these sweet potatoes that are on your table that's covered in sauce could actually be put into a little glass thing and become a forest.
I have a sort of different garden experience. I moved into an older home, and there was an established garden there, but it was hidden under all the untending, the non-tending that had gone on for years and years. And as I was yanking out this and yanking out that, I came upon little treasures that were there. Just waiting to break their way through the weeds and the lack of tending. Mm-hmm. And so the 15 years I've spent in that house has really been amazing, because I found things in that garden that are now flourishing that could not even get out from under the weeds before, before I started working there.
So for you, the garden is really giving birth to what's really already there. Nurturing what's already there, the secrets that are already there.
Partly that, partly then I took over and did some reorganizing of the whole thing to suit what I wanted, what my design of a garden. Mm-hmm. But the first years were spent finding the treasures that were already there.
Well, a thought I had as I drove up the valley was the importance of pruning in gardens, and what brought it to mind was the apple orchard. And for a long time, I saw the branches bound by a material, like a rope. And I wondered why, and then I realized it must be to hold them together so that they can maximize production, so that they're not all falling on each other, holding them up so that they can maximize the apple produce on the tree. And that could be an aspect to consider.
But another way of thinking of that is in any kind of in a lot of farming that we do today, we're trying to maximize production. So it's a whole different idea, caring for a garden versus maximizing production. That is getting the garden to produce. It's almost an opposite kind of thing. The idea first of letting what Jerry was saying about letting God do it and accepting sort of what God gives versus figuring out the best way, the most efficient way, and almost making a factory out of the hillside. That's, you can tell what my bias is, but yeah.
The garden for me, the one at my home, is for me a repository of beauty. And it's a place that I enjoy simply looking at the colors of the flowers, of the leaves, the juxtaposition of different plants, and it's a kind of communing with beauty, and I find it a source of nourishment and refreshment, maybe even a communion in the sense of experiencing the beauty of God. It's not practical. I don't grow any vegetables.
Right.
I just love to be in it and look at it.
That's very good. I think I'm ready to go on now. I wanted someone to say something about garden as a place of repose, garden as a place of refreshment. Because for many people, the Garden of Holden, at least that's why they come to Holden, it's a sense that up here in the woods where there aren't any phone calls and there aren't any vending machines, that somehow you will come into a deeper relationship with God, a deeper relationship with what is at the center of things. I'd like to turn to this Bible study now and just talk about how I had mentioned before how gardens crop up at some of the most critical places throughout the Old and New Testament, and also to look at the first garden, which of course is the Garden of Eden, to talk a little bit about the creation stories as we find them. I said stories, so why did I say stories? I gave it away.
There are a couple of them, I think.
Couple?
In the first.
Okay, who knows something about, does anybody know any characteristics of the two creation stories? What when they were composed, or what's the difference, or something about that? Did everybody know there were two?
Yeah.
Is there anybody for whom that's a surprise?
Two what?
Creation stories.
Oh yeah.
So it seems like everybody knows that. Does anybody know the difference between the two in terms of when they were written and by whom?
I think it seemed like the first one is considered more of a, it seemed like a priestly account or something that's the newer of the two, and the second one is considered more of the traditional version. I can't remember all the details of who wrote what.
Right.
But it seemed like the first one is kind of a flowery, poetic, priestly.
Mm-hmm. What's the most famous of the two, do you think?
The priestly one.
The seventh is creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and there was something upon the face of the deep. That's the priestly account. Now, just to give a bit of history, because this is actually very, very intriguing. The priestly account, the one that we know the most about, is most of chapter 1 with a couple of verses of chapter 2. It was written in about 400 years before Christ, 300 or 400 years before Christ. It was written at a time when the people of Israel were, in fact, not free. They had come back from Babylon. They had been conquered by Babylon. The whole civilization seemed like it was going to be destroyed. But God overturned Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, and the Jews were allowed by the next guy who was in charge, named Cyrus. The Jews were allowed to filter back home. It was a wonderful time of restoration for them. But when they got back home, they found out that things were not going to be that simple, that they didn't have the kind of power, the kind of grandeur. The temple was destroyed. What were they going to do, build a new temple? They basically came back to a city in ruins. And then they had to start building up from that. The fact that they couldn't be politically powerful meant that they focused their energy and their energy for control and for keeping things in order, focused that on the religion. And so they became a very priest-centered society. The priests, in fact, made up a lot of rules at that point in time. And they said, these are the rules that God gave to us. These are the rules that we have to follow to become a good people. They're very controlling, very analytical. If I had this right at the tip of my tongue, I'd tell you what type they were in terms of the Myers-Briggs. But they're very analytical, very into keeping things under control by invoking God. And they were the ones, when they came back from Babylon, they said, you know, we've got this creation story in chapter 2. But it ain't nearly as neat, as interesting, as powerful as the Babylonian creation story. Let's write a new creation story that seems to have a little bit more bite to it, a little bit more, you know, a little bit more scientific or a little bit more mathematical. So 7 days, a Sabbath day at the end, and we'll have man, woman being created in the last day, and let's see what would come on the first day. So that's how they wrote their creation story. And it's an interesting creation story, but it's a new one. Comparatively. Now we go to chapter 2, we get the older creation story. This story was written during the time of either King David or King Solomon, somewhere in there. Politically, at that time, Israel was in a much better place. They were on top of the world. David had finally subdued the Philistines. These were the sort of barbarians or whatever, the neighboring tribes that were warlike, you know, the story of David and Goliath. David was this romantic figure. If you think of the David and Goliath story, this little kid whips the stone, kills the giant, you know. It's a time when Israel thinks of itself as really being on top of the world. It's a youthful time, an exuberant time, exhilaration of power and of world status. I mean, it's sort of like the United States after World War II. I mean, the United States, if you'd read a history of the United States written after World War II, it would probably have the same sort of manifest destiny, you know. The United States is bringing peace to the world. You know, nobody knew at that time that the atom bomb was going to be such a problem. Nobody knew about the Korean War. Nobody knew about Vietnam. It was coming up. All of this. And today we find ourselves in a much different place than our parents, if your parents are that old, than our parents were at when they had subdued evil in the Second World War. The second creation story was written at a time like that. And so you find the creation story is much more confident. It sort of doesn't have to figure every minuscule detail out. It sort of says stuff that it feels. That whoever's writing it is really very in touch with his or her own joy and that God loves them and that there's that they can be creative without having to ask all kinds of questions of how does this fit in. So what we're going to be reading today in a creation story, second creation story, is one that's written by a people that's sitting on top of the world and feeling the power of God manifest in their own history. So it's a very confident story, and it's a very exciting story because of that.
I read the first five books of the Bible written by Moses. We always call them the five books of Moses.
We call them the five books of Moses primarily because the Jews called them the five books of Moses. But what we know by going through analysis of the text is that they're written at very different times by people with very different vocabularies. It would be as if all of a sudden all of the authors were taken off of all of the title pages in the library, and we went in there and said, well, these were all written by David Dahl. We know that David Dahl was up here at some point in the 1980s, and I think he wrote them all. And then we'd have all of these books, sort of, and we'd start going through them, and we'd notice that some people use a certain kind of language and images. Some of them seem to be talking about history. Some of them seem to be poetry. And then gradually we'd say, well, it looks like there's a bunch of authors here. It's not just David Dahl. That's what happened with the Moses theory. The Moses theory held until probably the time of the modern era, maybe 16th century, 17th century, and then people began to find some serious differences in the books between one book and another, between Genesis and Exodus, and then they found within the book of Genesis serious differences in vocabulary and style and whatnot, even within one book. So today what we have is an inheritance of, if you want to get technical, and I don't want to, in Genesis there's four authors, we think. And if you're interested in that, talk to me afterwards and I can explain to you a little bit about the four authors. But we're touching on two of them today. The priestly author, which is chapter 1, written in 400, and what is called the Yahwistic author, from the name Yahweh, which is how this guy refers to God. He calls God Yahweh. And that's most of the second creation story. So let's turn...
I think what could be said too would be that there's that the final, when you say the priestly author, that's the final shaper of that body material, or the Yahwist author, the final shaper, that they probably didn't make it up. They were working with very ancient material.
Mm-hmm.
That, right. I mean, some of the stories are thousands of years old, and really old stuff that they then would shape into. They were editors, maybe mm-hmm. more than authors.
That's right. It would be as if you were trying to write your family tree, a history of your family tree. You wouldn't just sit here and say, well, let's see, Merkel, let's see...
What do you make up about Merkel?
Yeah. What you would do is you'd do research on it and talk to a lot of people about it, and then you would write it, and it would be Jeff Merkel's account of the Merkels. But it would really reflect a lot of material that I didn't even know when I started. What I want to read is chapter 2, if you could turn to that, if everybody has a Bible. Chapter 2 of Genesis. The second creation story starts in chapter 2, verse 4. And why don't we read it sort of paragraph by paragraph? We won't go in a circle. Just whoever likes to read can read the first paragraph, and the next person can read the next paragraph.
I'll read the first paragraph, it's real short. These are the generations of the earth when they were created.
Any preliminary impressions on this garden? Anything that struck you as you were hearing it read?
Everything was provided,
okay. It's not the kind of garden that we have to do a lot of tilling at. It was already planted by God. Anything else?
A lot of relational stuff,
and this is wonderful. We'll get into this in a couple of minutes. First thing I want to look at is what was the status of the land in the very beginning, according to this story? What was it like?
Pretty dry.
That's another, there's a lot of dust, right? Another sign that there's a difference between the first creation story and the second. Go back to verse 1 of the Bible. What kind of territory did God have to work with when God created the world in the first story?
Water.
Yeah, lots of water. Lots of water. To summarize what's going on there, from you know, biblical history 101. There's chaos in both of these. God starts creating in chaos. And what is chaos for the people who wrote the first one? The first creation story? Chaos would be water, which means what? What would frighten them?
Flooding.
Floods. Mm-hmm. Floods or the sea. They're definitely landlocked people. The main struggle for them is seasonal flooding. Namely, this is a story that, the first creation story is a story that comes with a lot of influence from Babylon, a place where when the Tigris and the Euphrates flooded, everything was wiped out, big problem. So when God created the world, God stopped the chaos of the water and made order in the chaos of the water. That's the Babylonian creation story. The second one is the chaos is dust. So what kind of people are these?
People in a drought.
Yeah, people in a desert. People who, when they plant stuff and they don't get water, they start to die. So for them, when God creates the world, God starts with that kind of chaos and starts, and does what? I mean, look at what happens, verse 10 and following. In this desert wilderness, what do you got?
River came right into the garden.
You got rivers. Lots of rivers. When I read this as a kid, I thought there were four rivers on each side. And when I started to learn a little bit about geography, I thought, well, how? Geez, that would make it an island. How would these things flow? I mean, my image of this is just lots of rivers. You know, these wonderful rivers going through a garden. But the rivers are very important. And what's in the middle of this? Not just water as a sign of abundance. There's something else that is in that section that talks about the abundance.
Precious stones.
Precious stones. What else?
The tree of
gold. Life. Yeah. Gold. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, it's not just a sense of the in the desert chaos, there's plenty of water. I mean, if you think of we're thinking about this the first time, a place like Yakima, you know, where you have all of this fruit. All these fruit trees out here in the desert beyond the mountains. There, water is gold. You know, if you've got water, you can make a living, you can survive. If you don't have water, you can't do anything. So these are people who are really shaped by a sense of the abundance and the importance of water, irrigation. And their Garden of Eden is a place where there's water all over the place. Just lots and lots of water. How does the first man get formed by God?
Out of the ground.
Out of dirt.
Created, just made out of nothing.
Made out of nothing. But it is interesting that God forms the man. You know, it's almost as if God has hands in this one. You know, God shapes him. This account which comes during the time of David usually refers to God in anthropomorphic terms because they're not afraid of talking about God as if he's a buddy, as if he's something that you could understand. Whereas when you get to the time of the later account, God is really up in the sky and far away and distant, and you can't even use words in a way that would refer adequately to him. It's a difference between a child's ability to say, why did God do this? And an adult's wanting to say, well, the philosophy of existentialism dictates that God cannot be talked about in terms that, you know, human. It's a real difference in confidence, a child's confidence versus the sort of adult's skepticism about God. So here we have God as a man walking in the garden and taking some dust and forming it with loving kindness into what, and there's no attempt to explain how God can do that, because you don't have to if you have confidence about God. You just say, well, God did it. God is God. But what is the other thing that is said about the creation besides forming him out of the dust?
Breathing.
Breathing. What is breathing?
The breath of life.
Breathing and spirit are the same thing, right? Breath and spirit in Hebrew are the same. So as God breathes into the man, God gives the man the spirit of God. life, the life that is in God, which is what really the Hebrew people think of as spirit. Spirit is not this thing far away. It's life. It's real. It's what gives you the ability to move. It's a sort of, it's like blood or something. It's not abstract spirit. It's really much more life, a real thing. Okay. Now, what does man have to do in this garden? I mentioned this before. What's his responsibility?
Till it and keep it.
Till it and keep it. That's all he has to do. It's interesting that when we talked about our gardens, we talked a lot about how much work there was involved in it. But in the garden that we see in the Old Testament, there's really, it's almost as if there's this huge forest, and God says to the man, well, you know, do whatever you want to every day. Till it, keep it, it's yours. You know, it's not the Puritan sense of you have to work real hard. In fact, how many of you have read Paradise Lost? Do you know what Paradise Lost is about? People who haven't read it. It's about the creation. It's about creation and fall. It's John Milton's attempt to, as he says, explain the ways of God to man, I believe. I have to go back and read it. But what happens is that Milton is writing during the time of the Puritans, and Milton says that God put the people there simply to enjoy the garden in the beginning. It was God's design, puts the people there, almost like bringing us to Holden Village. It's not that we have to somehow mine copper out of the hills or somehow grow corn up on the hillside and export it. No, we are given Holden simply to enjoy. It's hard for some of us to enjoy it. I mean, we want to work. I get up at 6:30 in the morning, work on Bible study, just like I do at church. You know, it's hard for us to just let go and enjoy a little bit. But that's what Milton says God meant for humanity. The fall comes because Eve wants to, in Milton's poem, Eve wants to go out and be more productive. So she wants to go off on her own because she says to Adam, Adam, when we work together, we just talk and, you know, we have a nice time, but we don't get much work done. We have to get some work done here. And so it's a very interesting thing. John Milton is pointing out that the fall happens because of a desire in Eve to be more productive, to get more done. And so what happens is, of course, Eve goes off on her own, and it opens her up, because she's no longer in community, to really be seduced or convinced by the serpent that there's this other thing going on. But I'm kind of jumping the gun. All that the man has to do in the garden is take care of it for his own pleasure and for God's pleasure. It's a wonderful idea. The garden is there not as something that we have to work in, but something that, like David said, something we're to enjoy, to take delight in, just as God takes delight in it.
Marge Wohl would say that's a very sexist attitude.
Which is? Oh, you mean the Eve thing?
By John Milton.
Oh, John Milton. No, there's no question that John Milton's sexist. I wasn't saying that. But I think that his understanding of... and the creation story is sexist, too. Yeah. There's no question about that. But see, it would be sexist even if the man did it, because then it would be the men who had... if you've got two sexes and you want one of them to screw up, eventually you're going to have to say it's sexist, if you're looking at it from that point of view. Though, there's a lot in Hebrew scripture that's extremely male-dominated, especially the priestly stuff. Especially the priestly stuff. And that's priestist also, which means that only the ordained people are good and important, and the lay people are, like, insignificant. And that's something that Jesus comes to sort of overcome, because Jesus goes to the poor and the underdog people, the suffering people, and says that they're important. And the scribes and the Pharisees and those who know all of this law are the ones that are out of touch. So Jesus is constantly overturning our sexist or whatever presuppositions. So now we're back to, I'd like to look at verse 17. Those of you who have done English 1 or English 100, what literary convention is being used in verse 17? Somebody read verse 17.
But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall die.
Okay. So what does that introduce into this narrative of greenness and abundance?
And the foreshadowing?
Yeah, foreshadowing.
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Foreshadowing.
How about a challenge?
Yeah, possibly. It's a challenge that God gives to Adam, but it's a in terms of the narrative, it sort of foreshadows what's going to happen, what's coming. Because up until now, we've had nothing but God creating something out of a disaster of desert. You've got lots of water. You've got a man who has the life of God within him. You have a garden which this man is to till. It has everything in it that he could possibly want. And then God puts the man into the garden and says, you can do whatever you want, but don't eat of this tree. And
why did he do that? He knew they'd disobey.
Well, according to the narrative, God does not know that they would disobey. According to the narrative, God puts God's whole trust in these people. Now, in later years, theologians have said that God, in order to be God, has to be omniscient. God has to know everything. But that's not what this story says. This story says that God is sort of like you and me, in that God can trust people, and God can also be surprised by people. That's an aspect of the youngness of this author. This author is not concerned about philosophical consistency. For this author, God can be the God of the whole universe, but can also be very, very present to Adam and later to the woman, Eve, in a way that is almost disarming, very disarming, very poignant. So we have a whole different understanding about, if we were to do a systematic theology based on this particular passage, we would not have an omniscient God. God doesn't know what's going to happen. God simply goes with, partners humanity, goes as a partner of humanity and ends up being really disappointed, as we'll find tomorrow.
Wouldn't this kind of correlate with the temptation of Jesus, though? All of a sudden, you know, what he's saying here is, hey, you can have it all, you want tree of knowledge, and Satan's, as I'm jumping ahead, Satan's come along and said, God does not want you to eat of that, because you can have it all, you can be just like he is, and you turn around and here's Jesus being tempted by Satan, Satan's saying you can have it all, and Jesus is saying, you haven't got it, mm-hmm. because he says, I'll show you what all is.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's Satan is constantly trying to give us a false sense of what it means to be fulfilled and means to be human. That's true.
Teacher Bonhoeffer brings the whole thing on this creation of Paul that I really like about the tree being put right in the middle of the garden, because being human means learning to live with limits, and that God put a visible sign of the limits of Adam and Eve right in the middle of the garden. And that our constant struggle is to accept our humanity, which means an existence with limitations. Yeah, or like you say, we want to grasp at being God. And I think I see that in our consumeristic culture and everything, that we don't want to live with limitations. That's our huge struggle. We don't want to have our freedom limited in any way. And that this tree being in the middle of the garden that they weren't supposed to touch, was a reminder to them that being human is a joyful, celebrated existence, but it's also an existence with limitations.
That's a good point. That's a good point. So in a sense, God is handing to man the truth about existence when he hands it to Adam. He says to Adam, here it is, everything that you could ever want, plus there's a limit. Okay? Does that make sense? But it's a foreshadowing, because if you didn't know, if it were true that man were never going to push that, you probably wouldn't have to talk about it. It would perhaps never have come up. Why did God bring it up is something that you asked. I mean, if God wouldn't have brought it up, some people say, well, if God hadn't brought this up, then Adam would have never, if it's one tree in 10 million, he would have never really found out about it. So there's a way in which the writer of this narrative has a design. And one of the things that I want to remind you is that this is an exquisitely crafted story. So frequently we read these stories and we whip through them because they're short. This is exquisitely crafted. This idea of a tree of knowledge of good and evil sitting right there, and then, in fact, the way it works is sort of sparsity abundance. You see the sparsity of the ground being desert, and then the abundance of God breathing into a piece of this mud, God's spirit. So there's a kind of abundance there, and then there's another abundance when God creates all of the trees of the garden, and then all of these rivers that are flowing in through the garden, and the jewels and whatnot. God gives to humanity this garden, but then there's this minor note. Suddenly, you know, the bow strikes a minor note that there's this tree in the midst of the garden, a good tree, a tree of good and evil, knowledge, which is a good thing, good and evil. But there's this minor tone in the way the narrative uses it, because you have a sense something bad is on the horizon. It's wonderfully crafted. But immediately God turns again to the abundance in verse 18. It says, it's not good that this man should be alone. So what does God do? He says, man should not be alone, and he gives him a barnyard. Gives him chickens and pigs, and basically he sort of gives him a job. I mean, he says, okay, here are the chickens, the pigs, the panthers, the antelopes. Give them names, and what's going on there? I mean, if God is looking for a fit companion, is God sort of trying out different possibilities and not coming up with the right one?
Well, he didn't want to eat first, and so he gave him chicken. He didn't want to eat. Stomach was more important than that.
That's interesting. John Milton says that that carnivorosity was not yet instituted, but that was part of the fall. But maybe, I don't know, maybe eggs, wine. I mean, I think Adam and Eve were vegetarians, right? No, that's one part of it, that God sets up an economy, as it were. Maybe that's it, I don't know. What do other people think?
Man still got lonesome. These animals no longer satisfied.
Was it a joke, or was it God? Was it a mistake, or is God just...
I almost look at it as God, you know, God gave man dominion over the earth, and these were just part of what man had to basically rule over.
He needed somebody to cook the chickens and fix the eggs.
I'm not talking about woman or anything like that.
I think Joyce and you need to talk, actually.
That was a lot of work to identify all these animals.
Right. God made him into a biologist.
The sense of name is to identify, really. And you couldn't identify somebody that would be...
Some people say that God is...
Could rule over him.
Some people say that God is sharing with Adam, with the first man, God's creative energy, because he says to Adam, use language, just like I use language. God said, let there be light, and there was light in the first creation story. God speaking, in a sense, what God says happens. And so God says, okay, I'm going to create some animals. Boom, they happen. And God says, Adam, you try it. Just name these animals. See what it feels like to be a creator. That's what some people say. It's a nice idea. But in the flow of the narrative, what it does is it's another slowing down mechanism. It slows things down. As Valerie said this morning, slows things down until the crown of creation can be created, which is woman. sort of to reverse the fundamentalist thing, which is that man was created first and is more important. Maybe man and the animals are a prelude to woman, who does not need to, in a sense, does not need to name things to be able to create, because she is able to create in and of herself. In that sense, is more biologically attuned to God, who is also the creator. But I doubt that that's what the narrative has in mind. Maybe, I don't know. But let's just look at this a little bit. How is woman created? What does that say about anything, about her relationship to the man or about her relationship to God?
Well,
out of Adam's rib.
Out of Adam's rib. What do you all make of that? Anybody have any theories on that one? Why doesn't God just form her out of the dust like he did before?
So that's more of a relationship.
And how would you characterize the relationshipness based on the rib?
Be by the side.
Both of those are very good. Very good. That the rib is part of a side of us, and so therefore there's a kind of equality about using a rib that may not be there in using another part of the body. And also the business of the rib. You know, when somebody wants, if you're trying to tickle somebody, you go for their ribs. And the reason that biologically we are able to be tickled there is because it is the most vulnerable part of our body. If somebody wants to kill you, that's also where they would go to accomplish that. So the rib is really a place of and it's funny, you know, we think that the place of greatest vulnerability are the things that, you know, the genitals are the things that we're ashamed of or cover up. But in fact, the Bible sees the place of great vulnerability as perhaps being the ribs, being the torso, the body, the life. I mean, that's where the life is kept. If you kill somebody, the spirit goes out of them. They don't know how. The Hebrews don't know how people die, but they know that the spirit goes out of them. And the heart of the life is seen to be inside of the breast.
Ribs are the cage of the lungs, the breath of life.
Mm-hmm. Any other things on the rib? I mean, again, the fundamentalists would say that this makes woman less than man.
Well, I don't know Hebrew, and I don't know if you do, but there's Phyllis Trible does this whole thing in the book God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, of saying that it's not, up until this point, the word apparently used for the human one is Adama, or earth creature, and it's not necessarily man as male, so that it's almost more of a sense that there was one human being who was androgynous, and then it's a separation somewhat that occurs here too, because apparently that Hebrew word for Adam is not used after the point that the woman is created.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I knew all.
That's great.
It's Adama and Ish are the words, and there's another one for Adam that's used after this point. Mm-hmm. And I think that we as Christians really need to take this narrative seriously, because it has been used as a basis for a great deal of sexism that Phyllis Trible, an Old Testament scholar at Union Seminary, would claim is not in the text at all. Mm-hmm. And she says it's a play on words, Adam and Adama, that the word for earth, what is it? I don't know, anyway, that would be more correctly translated, instead of man throughout all of chapter 2 up to this point, that earth creature would be the correct word, because what's important in it is that it's one who was taken from the earth, and that's what we tend to forget, except that females and stuff, is that we're taken from the earth.
Yeah. And that also ties into what you were saying before about limits. Mm-hmm. You know, if we could really understand that we are creatures taken from the earth who have the breath of life, the life of God within us, but that there are limits. And we should not try to make ourselves into God and always be desiring everything. Yeah.
Also get a little bit of a sense that it's done. And I guess I get a picture kind of if you were to go back to the earth to create, and you'd be using totally new creative imagination, or it'd be a whole new creation, as opposed to taking the sense of the rib being material that you've already created.
Yeah.
And maybe enhancing or reworking to make something new, but out of something that's old, so it's not. I do it with computer programs all the time, I guess, is where I think of it. You know, if you're going to do something entirely new, then you start dreaming up how you're going to do it. If, on the other hand, you just want something that's similar to, and you know, you take from what you have and then you rework it a little bit and maybe enhance it or make some little changes, and then you've got some. So I get that sense of using a
the program.
Well, that's what I do. So, but you know, maybe Don would have the same. Could, you know, with a clay or an earthen material, where you maybe it's something that you worked with before. You could, and maybe it doesn't work with clay once you baked it, but you could. You could, you're taking from something, so you're not using a whole new imaginative process. You're taking something that's already there, and I don't know what that adds to
well,
the story.
Well, it's very, what I think is very interesting, what Barbara just introduced, is that when, if this is true, then when God takes the rib out of earth creature's side, earth creature changes too.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that just Eve is created, but man is created at the same time, and earth creature sort of disappears, and there's suddenly this bipolarity to existence, which where before there was just one polarity. It's almost as if God has discovered that man, that the earth creature that God has created can't exist without an equal, a co-equal, one that is exactly on the same level. And so God does something that maybe God hadn't even figured out yet at that point, at least in this story, which is to create a co-equal within, to have dialogue with and to respect and to honor and to all of that stuff. It's like Erickson talking about the stages of development, psychosocial development, if you've ever heard Eric Erickson. He says that there's a certain point in your life where intimacy is absolutely essential in order to grow. And if you don't master the task of intimacy, then you can't really grow beyond that stage into the other stage. And intimacy is the task of adolescence. It's a task of opening your heart to other people, or late adolescence, young adulthood. Opening yourself to other people, trusting them, being hurt by them, being able to spring back from that and continue to keep yourself vulnerable. It seems like God is discovering that man is never going to be really fulfilled until that the earth creature can't have that, and have that simply by dominating other things, other creatures and whatnot. But there needs to be some kind of co-equality, some kind of partner, in order for man to really develop who man is.
If it wasn't that God hadn't figured out that more, that man should figure it out for himself as he went along. I mean, that Adam would realize that even dominion over the animals wasn't enough, and so then God gave him Eve.
What's this? But for man, there was it's very passive construction. But for the man, this is verse 20, but for the man, there was not found a helper fit for him. So we're not sure who had not found the helper fit for him. If it was man who had named all of these animals and had talked to the giraffes and said, well, so what's going on today? And found that, you know, it wasn't fit. It just didn't work out. Or if it's that God, throughout this process of creation, was hoping that somehow things would fit together, and it had not yet coalesced, and so God came upon the solution for that. Maybe God knew that the solution, what the solution. That's why I asked if God was playing a little joke. If God knew beforehand that man would need a co-equal, or whether God simply discovered that in the process. This narrative does not tell us. If you want to write a systematic theology based on this narrative, you do not know. If you want to write a systematic theology based on the whole Bible, then you might want to say, well, God was omniscient. This story doesn't quite represent the fullness of God. God knew the whole time, and so God was just sort of, you know, just sort of waiting until he wanted to create the co-equal.
Just on the co-equal basis, though, we're kind of throwing out the word domination a lot, and yet, you know, a lot of circles, it's more termed as a stewardship sort of thing. And it seems like a lot of people have thrown out the phrase that there wasn't any work to do, you know, that this was sort of just playground. And yet if you think of it as stewardship over the garden, some of that tilling and keeping, there really was a sense of responsibility there. And mm-hmm. the word helper is used as being, when you use the term man or earth creature or whatever term you're using, couldn't do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
That there was need for that helper,
yeah.
That co-equal, that other.
And helper, in this sense, we figured out in the first session, means helper in the sense that God is a helper of humanity, not in the sense of a servant, that someone is better and someone is less. And that's very interesting. God calls himself the helper of mankind in places in the Psalms. And so we see the companionship here as really being a co-equal kind of thing. I'm about 5 minutes behind. Two things that we want to hit before we quit is, therefore a man leaves his father and his mother, cleaves to his wife, and they become one flesh. And the other thing, they were both naked and were not ashamed. One flesh, what does that mean? One flesh. In the context of leaving father and mother, what does it mean to become one flesh?
I mean, united physically as well as spiritually and emotionally.
united physically, sexual intercourse. Okay? Any other ideas?
It seems like it means you'd almost have a closer relationship than you have with your parents to me sometimes, or at least equal to that, like a parents from a longer term. And I don't know, I've ever gone to a wedding or something, it's always been such a striking thing that they say, you know, it's like you leave something behind and you just...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There is a definite leaving behind, a part of the process of becoming one flesh. You can't become one flesh without leaving something behind. Is that true? How about people who are married? Do you have any insight in that? Or people have been married, or people have been in relationships where you feel like that's been true? One flesh.
Mm-hmm. The word become is pretty important to me.
Mm-hmm.
The harmony or the becoming.
It's a process.
The attraction, the process.
Yeah, I think that's real important here.
It's a different kind of bonding that you have with them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hint of permanence in it too, because somewhere else it is written that whoever joins himself to a harlot becomes one flesh with her, and like it's a permanent thing, and then with harlots they go apart again, and then they're one flesh, and then they're looks like they're ripped apart.
Well, that's
or
good.
Something.
That's good. So something psychological happens that opens you up to that person in a way that you can never really close off, even though you might go away from them. Is that what you mean? That's nice. I like that.
And there was the same story with Jesus when that one woman came up to him and he said something about her husband. He says, well, you've had 7 husbands.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't really judge that, which is kind of nice. So, I was thinking about the mother and father thing too. If you go back to the garden of your youth, which is the time when you were like the author of this narrative, when you were a child and when you saw things as all being connected, and perhaps you didn't have a kind of idyllic childhood. Oftentimes, even kids that don't have idyllic childhoods don't feel terrifically pained by that. They have resource or whatever that they can live abundantly and unquestionably in the context even of their parents not being terribly close. But for those of us who had okay families, there's this sense that our mother and father were one flesh. In the garden of our childhood, we talked about them as mom and dad, mama, papa. I, as a 4-year-old, would not have said Esther and Sterling about my parents, you know. They were not individuals, they were not differentiated, even from each other. They were mom and dad, one thing. And there needs to be a sort of breaking away from that kind of sheltered life and going into your own world of creating between the two of you, between, say, Anne and me. There's Anne and there's Jeff, there's Anne, and then we get married, there's Anne and Jeff. There's a kind of, so if you want to have us over to dinner, you'd say, Anne and Jeff, would you come over to dinner? You wouldn't mean, Jeff, you can come, and you know, maybe Anne can come. the other thing that's interesting about that is if you invite Anne and Jeff to come to dinner, the one flesh part of us, and then Anne and Jeff have a fight, it's extremely disconcerting to you that we would differentiate when you wanted us to be one flesh, when you wanted us to be speaking in sort of one voice, doing our Anne and Jeff routine, you know. there's a kind of one flesh which happens. We become, certainly to our children, we would be Anne and Jeff or mom and dad for a while, and that one flesh is, I think, real important.